quick. I'm Jewel, not Holly. How many expected a girl? There you go. Every time I would give my name, there's always somebody that expected a girl. Well, I want you to know I identified with that song of Johnny Cash, A Boy Named Sue. I want to thank Bob for whatever he did to get me up here, and thank all the people up here. You know, I'm really impressed with this place. I want to really congratulate whoever got involved in getting this going, because this is quite a meeting. And it reminds me of the old Central meeting down at the War Memorial, which takes me way back. I want to congratulate the cake takers and the 90-day tokener. He come up and introduced himself, and I'm highly impressed in all of that, because you know what? That's what keeps it rolling. It shows the newcomers what we really got. There's something big going on here. See, I didn't know that when I come in. And there was no newcomers here tonight? None at all, huh? Just a few newcomers that didn't hold their hands up? Well, hang on. If you stick around, hang on. Because right now, this, you know, whenever your first meeting was, or if this is your first meeting, I want you to know you did hook into something big and don't even know it. See, and I didn't even know it when I hooked into it. But the girl that, what was it, 20-some years and turning 50? Congratulations. I got boots that old. I come in when I was 30. I'm 78 now. I've been sober 46 years. Little did I ever. I got an old schoolmate back here, an Al-Anon. He watched me in school and he wouldn't drink. But he picks on me every time he speaks, so I got to pick on him a little bit. He said every time he was a hall monitor, and every time I come down the hall, he'd run and hide in the bathroom. But anyway, it's good to be here, and I've seen a lot of my old friends that I've met through the years on Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's really a privilege to be here amongst all of you. And Ski, I remember Ski when he was delivering mail in a Cadillac. And Bob was working with the union halls, well-dressed with the tie pulled loose and a diamond stick pick, pin tie clip and a cuff links unbuttoned and the cuffs up. And I thought, boy, I want to be like that. Bob, stand up. Everybody knows you, but I want everybody to... Put me on the spot, I'll put you on the spot. But he's been my hero for years. Always was my hero. And you know, Bob always had something great to say and was always there for me. He was in a meeting when a half pint fell out of my hip pocket. It was a little closed meeting down in National City, and not a soul turned around to see what it was. And the next week, I went, finished my drunk, and come to the same meeting the next week, and they called on me, and I said, I can't believe that when that half pint fell out of my hip pocket and landed on the floor, because I had to get up and go around the bench and pick it up. I can't believe anybody turned around and didn't look. And every speaker after that said, we knew what a half pint sounded like when he hit the floor. They didn't have to turn around and look. But that was a savior meeting down there that Wednesday night, closed men's meeting. It was the only other meeting in town other than the central meeting down in the War Memorial Building. And it was created through a guy that got a resentment against central meeting, central office. And the thing was, he'd gotten a divorce and his wife was with another guy, and he'd show up at the meetings. And so they put a restraining order against him. So he said, they can't keep me out of meetings. And he went to the central office at how can they keep me out of an AA meeting? They said, we don't get into outside controversy. So he started that meeting. He was there for years, right? Oh, John Long, he was a great guy, and he passed on a long time ago. I got great memories of when I first come in, and I got great memories just right up until today. I mean, it's just, I was born back in Missouri, 1930. I rode to kindergarten with my school teacher in a horse and buggy down a dirt road. And, you know, somebody talking about TV or something. Hell, I remember when TV was invented. I can remember when you had a radio, you had to have an antenna spread from the house to the barn, and you could only get three stations. So, you know, I can go way back and think of when I was born, and AA started in 1935, 5 years after I was born. Now, as far as I'm concerned, you know, this is a spiritual program. It started out with two guys, but Bill Wilson, I think, was the spiritual guy that was had God lay his hand on his shoulder way back a long time ago when he was at the Oxford group, which was kind of a religious-oriented type of group, but it was similar to Alcoholics Anonymous, but he took it a step farther. He broke away from religious training into spiritual attitude. And the spiritual attitude is that God loves us. He does not condemn us. And I had to come here and learn that God stood around and let me have my way, let me kick my butt long enough until he said, when I said, I'm ready, he said, okay, I'll show you how to forgive yourself. And that's what this program does. That's what the people here shares with us. It's the simple, easy way of getting out from under the old us. I had some memories today. I don't know how many of you saw it in the newspaper that they were selling the old jail doors and the old beds and the old toilets and the old sinks down at the city jail. My old alma mater. Me and my kid went down and bought a truckload of them stuff. And then Channel 6 interviewed me as one of the inmates. So now all of San Diego knows my name's on the wall down there. And they asked what we was going to do with the doors. And my son hollered out, we're going to put them on his granddaughter's bedroom. Boy. All of you have heard my story and told about when my kids was little and I put them on the edge of the refrigerator and they'd jump off to me. They would just completely trust me. They had all the faith in the world that I'd catch them. They just knew I was going to be there all the time. And I learned from my kids what it was like to have complete trust in a higher power, in something that's going to always be there. I was always hanging on the refrigerator. Okay, God, you sure you're going to catch me this time? My kids always knew I was going to catch them. And I told this story several times, and one day it dawned on me. It never once entered my mind. I think I'll step back and let this one hit the floor. Never entered my mind. But yet, we have a little doubt if God's going to be there for us, right? Or our higher power, if the word God bothers you. I went to my kid. I want my kids to stand up. This is my daughter. Stand up. Aww. This is my son. His wife, Jill. This is Debbie and Duke. This is Jill, his wife. Stand up, Jill. Debbie's husband, Bob. Yeah. Granddaughter, Heather, that we're going to put the jail sword on. Now, I want you to know, I might catch Debbie, but I ain't even going to try to catch Duke if he comes up. But, that, you know, I learned, if anybody that's, you know, coming into AA now and really wondering what's here and everything, just be patient and take the road easy and follow through, because it's a great road. you're going to really, really have a ride. I mean, like I said, I was born in 1930 back in Missouri. Little did I know, probably God had things ready for me all as along. Anybody remember Benny Hill?
Yeah.
Remember that little old man? Benny Hill guiding. All through my life, I think God's treated me like Benny Hill did that little old man. He's guiding me through life. And I didn't even know it. I had no idea. I didn't go to churches at all. Had no belief in any kind of a thing other than just knew that there had to be some kind of a God out there that created something. But through my coming through life and the life I led, I'd be hanging in bars that the people that went to church on Sunday would stop in and have a few drinks, and they'd get into them arguments about church. And it didn't make any difference who was right. I was headed in the wrong direction. I was headed doomed for hell, as they said it, called it. And I knew that I was going in the wrong direction. And some little drunk at the end of the bar would say, "You guys shut up down there, there ain't no God." And I'd move down there and think, "I hope this guy knows what the hell he's talking about." Because I'd rather just meet the worms. I want to know part of it. But my biggest problem was, if I could have been like that guy, I think I would have felt much better. My biggest problem was that I really did believe. I didn't want to believe, but I did believe. And that's what whipped me. But through life and through getting to Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned that there was no punishment with this higher power at all, as far as I'm concerned. Now, when I come to San Diego in 1942, 12 years old, we left. My dad was a sharecropper. We left the farm and come out here. Now, I don't know if any of you remember Grapes of Wrath, but 1942 wasn't that far away from Grapes of Wrath. They didn't like hillbillies in California. And I come out here and I was a hillbilly. Had bib overalls on. Went to Fremont School. And they called me hillbilly. Now, I mean, Mexicans in here, no offense, I love you Mexicans. So I got some big backups up here. But Fremont was aggressive little Mexican kids that would just kick the hell out of little hillbillies. And there was one chubby, husky, tough Mexican that was born without ear. Had no ear at all, just had a hole in the side of his head. And his name was Lalo. And they called him Hole in the Head. Called me Hillbilly. And we teamed up. So we protected each other's backs. 25 or 30 years later, I'm up at the fair up in Del Mar, and here's this fat Mexican with one ear missing, sitting on the wall there with a bunch of little kids running around him. And I walked up and I said, "Lalo." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Jewel, sixth grade." "Jewel?" I said, "Hillbilly." "Hillbilly, God damn." He said, "What a memory." I said, "Yeah, I got a great memory. I wasn't about to mention that damn ear." Lalo still looked pretty tough. So anyway, and that, you know, it all started from there. When I was 17, I think, I went by to pick up this girl with a couple of buddies up out in La Mesa, and we had a few drinks, and I knocked on the door, and her stepfather comes to the door and said, "You can't take my daughter out in that while you're drinking." And he shut the door right in my face, and my two buddies in the car. So what did I do? I put a foot through his door. And I got in the car and they said, "You showed him." About 2 o'clock in the morning, the police showed up at my house. They damn near took my dad. Because his name is Jewel too. And so they took me to La Mesa, 17 years old. And now the bailiff says at the court, I had to get up in court, and the bailiff said, "The people of California versus Jewel W. Johnson." And it's like a light come on. the whole damn state's against me. I knew it. And that was my attitude until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the whole damn state's against me. Nobody likes me. And I'm a victim. All that alcohol stuff. And I ended up in Vista Hills. I worked in the shipyards. Was a good welder. The old boss told me, he said, "You're one of the best welders I got, but anymore I have to chase down the lead ship. You're on the other end. You keep taking off, and I don't even know it." And while we met some friends out here. My dad and mother went to work at Convair, and then my dad ended up in the shipyard, and I followed him into the shipyard. But there was two friends that rented equipment, and they always had a bottle with them. They, no matter where, what party, when they ever come around, they'd have a fist sitting by the chair leg. And they were always happy. They was always right in that mellow stuff we always looked for. I mean, when I got there, I just went right on over. But they'd sit right in that spot. And they both died when they was in their 50s. But the family called them alcoholics. Now, as far as I know, that's the first time I ever heard of alcoholics. But they were sociable, drinking people that just nipped all the time and just stayed in that buzz and worked every day. I was on and off of work. I was in and out of jail. And had a couple of detectives named Lutz and McGuire. I'll get into that later, I hope. But Lutz and McGuire, McGuire was the mean guy and Lutz was the good guy. And McGuire would say, "We're putting you away this time." He'd say, "I'm going to go make a phone call, talk to him." Lutz say, "Boy, you better go in there and straighten out, because McGuire's mad this time. Yeah, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do?" So I'd always do whatever Lutz told me. Go in and plead guilty. Judge Brennan, I was talking to some of the police down here at the jail while we was buying our jail stuff. While I was performing on Channel 6. 10 o'clock tonight. You'll see me on Channel 6, unless they cut it out. But the thing is, the old boss told me one day, he said, "You know, if you don't knock off that kind of drinking you're doing, you're going to turn into an alcoholic." And I thought, boy, I'll be glad when I do. This kind of stuff is killing me. When you're in your 20s, dying at 50, you don't sound too bad. You know, so I could just picture myself turning into an alcoholic and nipping and no more trouble. Because I was doing a life sentence on a weekend installment plan. My dad used to tell me every time you go to jail and you call me on a Friday night, he said, "I'd roll over and sleep like a baby. I knew he's going to be okay for the rest of the weekend." So all of you know. It sounds like a lot of you have been there. So I ended up in Vista Hills, and the doctor over there, Dr. Campbell, talked to me, and I ended up coming to AA and later found out he'd been sober for 13 years then. And he mentioned AA, so that's when I first come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, my mother picked me up, so she called AA for me. And so I found out they had a meeting on Wednesday night down to War Memorial. And she's going to drive me down. So as we're going down there, I start getting more nervous, getting a little shaky. And I said, "You better stop right here. I think I left a $5 post-dated check in this bar here." She said, "Okay." So I run in and give me a double shot. Shot it down real quick. Come back out. They caught it just in time. Got down about Mount Market Street where Beasley's or whatever it is, and I said, "I think I left one here too." And she said, "I'm sure you did." I ran in and throwed down another double shot. Come out and said, "I caught that one too just in time." And she said, "Yeah, I should have." So we got to the central office, central meeting, and there's about this many people there. And I sat over at the side. And a guy sitting there, and I said, "Is this AAAA?" I couldn't stop on them A's. And he said, "Yeah, buddy, you're in the right place." By the way, he was an Al-Anon. And after the meeting, he said, "There's a bunch of guys back in the back here having coffee. Maybe you can meet a few people and get acquainted." And I told my mother, "Go on, I'll catch a ride home." So I went back And now I run into an old welder I'd worked with named Jim. Now, Jim was the kind of guy, every Monday, if he made it, he was shaking like this. And if he didn't, he'd come in on Tuesday like this. And if you said, "What are you shaking so bad, Jim? Why do you shake so bad?" He said, "Runs in the whole, my whole family does this." And I told him one time, "Do they straighten up about Thursday?" Look, when Jim would come in, we'd give him a level, a little short level, called a plumb level. We'd have him in that level and say, "Hold that on level, Jim. Can't do it." So I ran into old Jim. He's sober. He told me about AA, and he was sober, looking good. And I didn't know it, but I didn't know they were sober at the time. And so he started driving me around. He took me up to a meeting in Paradise Hills. And I looked, and it was down in the basement. Remember the old basement meeting up there? And I looked around, and I thought, how are they going to get all these people in this little tiny room? I thought that was all the drunks in the world, and they just followed each other around. Because somehow Jim had told me when he did quit drinking, when I talked to him down at the shipyard, that a bunch of alcoholics go to meetings together and keep each other out of trouble. Now, he didn't mention they didn't drink, or I didn't hear him mention it. And about halfway through the Paradise Hills meeting, it dawned on me, these damn people don't drink. Because I'd had a few that day. And so he dropped me off, and I went out the back door over to the bar and drank again. The next morning, I was too sick to go to work, so I stayed home. And I spent the whole day plotting that, you know, when Jim comes by, I'm going to tell him that it's good for him. I'm proud of him, but I just don't need it. I don't need that AA. So Jim come by about 6 o'clock, because the meetings were all 8:15 back then, about 6 o'clock, we was going to go to have a sandwich together. And he come in and said, "You've been drinking?" And I drank all day and plotted, you know, I'm going to tell Jim I don't need it. And he said, "You've been drinking?" I said, "Yeah, I've had a couple of those." I kind of almost fell over on the couch. And he said, "You're pretty drunk. Maybe you better not go tonight." Now, I've been planning all day to tell him I wasn't going. But us alcoholics don't handle rejection that good. So I said, "Who in hell do you think you are to tell me?" I want everybody to meet my illegitimate kid. Stand up. One day we said something anyway, he called me Daddy. So I called him Son. And like Dennis, a friend of mine, he said he was, you know, once we got close and talking in AA, and he said, "My mother was only 15 when I was born." And he said, "My grandparents raised me." And he said, he was in from Texas. He said, "I actually never met my dad." I said, "Was your mama ever in San Diego?" And he said, "Daddy." So Dennis died last year, and he always called me Dad. Called Duke and Debbie, his little brother and sister. So, you know, AA is just, it's a real tight knit. And, you know, the people you meet here are real, just outstanding, just good family. I mean, you just feel like, once, I don't know how many of you ever noticed, but you talk to somebody for 10 or 15 minutes, and all at once you feel like you've known them forever. And then no matter where you go, it's the same feeling. But anyway, that Friday, he took me into the meeting, and I sloshed in. They took me down and fed me coffee, and I sloshed in that meeting. And so they had, at the end, they asked if anybody wanted to sign up. Well, by then, I was ready to, you know, I was fired up. You know, I had 2 hours sobriety. So I went up afterwards. I said, "Sign me up." And she said, "Shh, when did you have your last drink?" I said, "Hell, it's been almost 2 hours now." She looked at the leader and said, "Aren't they supposed to have 24 hours to sign them up?" And he said, "I don't know, I'm new at this." I said, "Well, put me down for tomorrow." So I started with tomorrow's date. But I was asked to tell what they first told me when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And Ben Edgerton, the first thing he did when I when I met him, he said, I don't know how many of you remember Ben Edgerton from Chula Vista, but he said, stick around, kid, it'll get spooky. And I thought, just what I need, some spooky stuff. And then he said, in AA, we present the book to new people. He said, and we're also examples of the book. And he said, when you're at a podium, and that was back when everybody smoked, I mean, smoke was down to your neck. And he said, and I smoked then. And he said, when you're up at that podium, there's no reason to have the cigarette hanging out of your mouth. Present yourself well. And you treat these women that come in this meeting like ladies until they know they are. And I never forgot that. And that's what he said. And then they said, you may be the only copy of the big book some new person is going to see. So they just told it like it was. He was the newcomer of the week. There wasn't busloads of newcomers back then. So I was the newcomer of the week. And the spooky part, probably about three, four weeks later, they had the banquet. It's about the only thing they had in San Diego then was the anniversary of San Diego. Now, AA was only 25 years old when I come in. The banquet, I think, was 14. It was the 15th banquet. And I mean, this was El Cortez, the biggest building we had in San Diego at the time. And I want you to picture this in your mind, or you might have seen old pictures. But I mean, the women come in all dressed up in these fancy clothes with long gloves, hats with a veil down over the face, maybe a little fur over their shoulders. The men all dressed up with nice ties and cufflinks and really. And so I dug out an old double-breasted suit with a bunch of holes burned in it. And went to, they bought, in fact, I think Ben bought me the ticket. I think it was $3.50. And he made the remark, they're going to price the newcomers right out of these places. $3.50 was a lot of money back in 1960. So I get in there, and here's these white tablecloths, all the dishes matched, all of the silverware laid out the way it's supposed to be, and I had to know which one, I had to ask which one to use first. And Chuck Chamberlain was the speaker. Now, Chuck Chamberlain, I don't know how many of you have heard him, but his tapes are good, but they don't give what Chuck Chamberlain had in person, because Chuck Chamberlain had a charisma that just when he started talking, within 5 minutes, he captured the audience. The whole audience was captured, and he just rolled that stuff out, and he just every once in a while have a little chuckle. And I'm sitting there, and I grabbed onto my seat, and I thought, this is what Ben's means. This is spooky. Because all at once I knew there was something big going on in this room, in these rooms, and I was being a piece of it. So that's when I really knew that there was something great going on here. Now, spooky stuff, if you want to, you know, if you hang around and watch for the little things. I wanted to believe that there was something big in this higher power, and I wanted to believe that it was a figure. And I'd sit in my room and think, God, if you really exist, can you just stand in the corner of my bedroom for just a few minutes and glow? Get rid of all of my doubts. Now, if he had, I'd have went through the back wall. But when you stick around and you watch for the little things, all at once you're aware that there's something, that there is something going on. There's something. I was sitting at the South Bay Pioneers one day, and I'm wanting to believe, and I'm wanting to have some proof. And the wind blew. And I was sitting out in the yard, and the grass was about that tall. And the whole yard blew like a wheat field. And I just asked him to give me a sign. And one blade of grass right in front of me went the other direction and went right in my face. And I looked at it and I thought, what the hell did that? Then it dawned on me that I'd asked for a sign. And that's all it took. And, you know, I had some of these brains, you know. We have to be careful coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, there's a lot of people too smart for this program, but there's nobody too dumb for it. And I thought, that gives me a chance. But a couple of guys said, I was probably a damn gopher. And I said, well, God put that gopher right there at the right time and at the right spot. So, you know, you can start putting those things together. And as you go through life and as you practice this program, you start seeing all these things. And I could share thousands of little miracles that I've seen and little reminders that there's something great, something big. And I don't need a burning bush or a glowing figure in the corner. All I need is, and you can look at the eyes and the people in the groups like this and know that there's something big going on here. And we're part of it. We're hooked into it, every one of us. Each one of us is a piece of that thing. Joe Conley was an old timer back then. And old Joe, I love that story about him. I was telling Bob. Bob said he'd never heard it. Excuse me. But when he first come in, he had a sponsor named John. And he used to tell John, I can prove that I don't need the second step. I got a release from Patton State Hospital that says I'm okay. I'm not insane. So after he bragged about it for about a month, old John said, let me see that damn paper, Joe. And Joe pulled it out and showed it to him. And he looked at it and he read. He said, this don't say you're sane. It said, further treatment would be of no benefit. So here we are. So, you know, the thing is, when my kids was in the sixth grade, they took a gun away from a kid in the sixth grade over in National City, and I put them in the parochial school. Now, I knew no parochial school. So my wife had been a Lutheran, so they started checking out the Lutheran churches. So they found one in Chula Vista, and so the kids started going to that church. And I'd show up, watched every through a couple of months. The old preacher one time said, Mr. Johnson, how come we don't see more of you? I said, if I come every day, you wouldn't make me such a special. Us alcoholics always want to be special, you know, because when I got there, well, yeah, I got a hug out of it. But I ended up being friends with a lot of the Lutheran preachers. And so I went on a retreat one time with Duke and all the preachers and all the Lutheran men. And one of the coaches, now when Duke was in the playing football and when Debbie was volleyball, and I was in every game, because I was 36 before I had kids. I won't tell your ages. But Debbie was a week old when I quit smoking. That's 42 years ago, so figure that out. But these coaches, I went to the football game the very first, and I bought a van so I could help haul the football team. And the coaches called me down on the bench down where they were. Said, what are you doing up there in the bleachers? I said, I'm going to watch the game. Said, get down here with us. So for 4 years, I sat down on the bench with the coaches. And when we was up on a retreat, one of the coaches, they all knew I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said that he'd heard a lot of real good stuff about it. And he said, and about the higher power, he said, with your kids in Christian school, he said, are you a Christian? And I said, I suppose. I don't know. But I got baptized when they did. That's all I meant, is he smeared something on me. But I said, I guess. What's a Christian? He said, well, Jesus Christ. And he said, you believe in Jesus Christ? And I said, I don't disbelieve. But I wasn't there. I'm an alcoholic. But I believe in God. He said, well, Jesus was a God. I said, if he's God, I believe in him. But just in case he ain't, I go over his head. And that's my belief in, you know, with religion. I know there's a higher power. I know there's something big, and I know I'm hooked into it, and I know it loves me. And I know it loved me even before I ever found out it did. And I found out that God loved me through a lot of work and pain and following directions with this Alcoholics Anonymous. And the big thing is that I worked the third step in jail. I'd fallen off, went back out, tried again. And I'm laying in jail with about three real good heavy charges. I thought they was heavy. And I said, well, maybe a year in jail would help me get squared away. So I'm laying there and I got down on the side of the bunk and I said, okay, God, it's in your hands. I give up. I just want to get straight. And I crawled up on that bunk and I felt a sense of relief that I'd turned it over. And about 10 minutes, the bailiff come in and said, the detectives want to talk to you. And I said, okay. So I went out there and he said, well, you know, you've been a pain to us for a long time. But he said, last night, half of Chula Vista was PO'd at you. But today, we can't find anybody to sign the plate.
Spooky.
See? Said, we can't find anybody to sign a complaint. So if you got somebody to bail you out, it's $15 bail for drunk. Said, give him a phone, let him make a phone call. And I called my dad, and he said, yeah, I'll come get you. So they put me back in that cell, and I laid down, and I thought, wow, this third step works fast. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that was the day I worked the third step. Now, a lot of people say they work it every day, and I'm sure that they do. But I know that day I worked that third step. I let go. I turned it over. And to this day, I have never changed my mind on that night. There's times I've gotten away. There's times I got a little resentment. But I always stop and think, do I want to take this back or do I want to leave it in God's hand? And the answer is always, so far up until this time, I believe I'll let him keep it. He's done a pretty damn good job. Now, the detectives I was talking about, McGuire and Lutz, I had about 9 years of sobriety, and McGuire showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think Paul Hansen brought him down to the Wednesday night meeting, and he'd already told him I was here, and so anyway, McGuire come in, and he looked across the room and saw me, and he come walking over, and I thought, oh, God, here he is. So he come over and shook my hand, and he said, we heard you'd straightened out. Me and Lutz have been really proud of you. And he said, I'd come on the AA about a couple of weeks ago, I think he said. And he said, we got to go up and get Lutz. Lutz is up in Linda Vista drinking himself to death. So he called me within a week, and him and I went up and got Lutz. And Lutz was drunk. We walked in his door. We always knew you was a good kid. So we drug Lutz in. Both of them got at least 12, 14 years before they died. Now, what kind of a miracle can you ask for? The detectives, it was always there. And actually, they always tried to help me. But I didn't know it. But then I never did do a lot of jail time, long time. I did a lot of weekend installment plans. But to be able to work with a couple of guys that had worked against you in the court. So, and once when I come out of that jail after I'd felt like I'd worked the third step, I come out writing. I mean, I wrote, because all at once I knew that the force in that. What happened is I come out of there and I went to a meeting. A guy was almost telling my story. And he was talking about writing the fourth step and the fifth step and getting on into the program. So I started writing. I carried a little book with me. And he told me, get everything in there you can think of. If something goes in that shouldn't have been, it ain't going to hurt. But if you leave something out, it could be a distraction. So everything went in. You looked at me wrong, you went in my damn book. People cut me up on the freeway, they went in my book. I ended up with about 40 pages of inventory, and half of them probably shouldn't have been there, but it was full of stuff that needed to be in there, and the heavy stuff. And when I was finished, now my idea of a fifth step was to go down here, Arizona, on a Navajo the Indians, and find an old Indian they shoved in a cave that's about 110 years old, ready to die, and go in there and tell him a fourth step and throw in a bear. But they told me not, you know, not to think about who I was going to take it with until I finished the fourth step. Now, when it only took me a week. I mean, I was writing thoroughly. I mean, sometimes I couldn't hardly keep up with the pencil. The stuff was coming out so fast. Resentments and fears. And I tell you, the first fear was the boogeyman. My dad had told me the boogeyman was outside when I was a kid to keep us inside so the horses didn't tromp us or we didn't run through fences. So he said there was a boogeyman out there. Now, he didn't intend for me to have a boogeyman for the next 30 years. So that was the beginning of the fears. But the big thing is I was at a Sunday night meeting, and this guy said, he says, and he was telling my story almost, and he says, there's somebody in here ready to take a fifth step. He said, I'll guarantee you if you took all of our inventories and you threw them in a pile and you take the names and the places out of it, you couldn't find your own. He said, we're that close of being alike. And he said, if there's anybody in here that's writing a four step, and I was curious about what I'm talking about, he said, step out in the yard after the meeting and I'll share a couple of things about myself. So after the meeting, I walked up and I said, you want to step out in the yard? He said, yeah. And so I said, we went out and I said, share a couple of things. So he told me a couple of things and I said, would you like to listen to my fifth step? Now, here's what he said. He said, it'd be an honor. It's a privilege for me, another alcoholic, that you've come to when there's all kind of people out there, preachers and people with papers that does this stuff, and you come to me just another drunk. He said, so that's quite an honor. Pretty good, you know. I ain't a bad guy at all. I treat this guy pretty nice. So I said, when you was talking, you kept staring at me. Was you talking to me? Why were you staring at me? He said, because you were staring at me. Had no idea he had such a grip on me. So I went and took the fifth step with him. And took practically all day. And he had an office in his garage, and that's where we took it. And when we'd go in for coffee, I'd be the first one right back out there, and I'm reading again. And when we got done, we burned it. And he had an old bucket there, which was just an old metal bucket that was just black from burning fifth steps. And then he got the water hose and we put some water in, and he had me an old stick that had been burnt, an old broomstick, and he said, now stir that up. And I stirred it up and he said, throw it down my driveway. I said, this mud? He said, throw it down. There's a lot of good people piled down there. And I threw it down and he handed me the water hose and he said, now wash that guy away. You never have to be that person again if you don't want to. And man, it's just like the world lifted off my back. Now he said, you're going to have to continue writing inventories. He said, pick out, you know, you already know what your defects of characters are. You know who you old men's to. But you need to continue writing inventory because the old you is still there under the surface. You've just uncovered the real you, but it ain't going to have to stay long if you don't work on it. So I started writing daily inventories. For 3.5 years, I wrote a daily inventory. And every day I'd have a full page, and the last two lines was, thank God for this way of life. Thank God for this day of sobriety. And then a guy that, by that time, I'd had a good friend, Barney was his name, and I'd catch him and I'd say, Barney, I got a month of inventory. Would you like to listen to it? But sure. About the third time I asked him, he said, you mean that little diary you keep? I said, well, if you don't want to hear it, I'll get somebody that does. He said, no, I was just kidding. I said, too damn late, you're going in it. So when he listened, Barney was in it. He made fun of my inventory. But the tenth step, you know, a lot of us, when we come in and we think about the steps and everything. But the fifth step actually brings us to a beginning. And we think when we get to the fifth step, we've made quite an effort, which we have. And we think we've really worked a program. That's the beginning. It's not the finish. The finish is from the fifth step on. And when you start trying to practice the principles you learn here, trying to get away from the old defects of character and trying to find the new person, you continue to uncover and discover, as old Chuck Chamberlain says. And so through the years of practicing, I finally found out the real me. Just me. You know. But I like it. I can look back and know that God's been in my life continuously. He's looked after me from the minute I was born, and He's always there with me. And I try to share that, and I try to practice it, because Alcoholics Anonymous is my life. These kids down here wouldn't even exist if it hadn't been for Alcoholics Anonymous. And so many good things has happened. I've had a successful business. I bought the property when it was so damn such a good deal I couldn't not buy it. I wasn't a property kind of guy. I wasn't a guy that you go out and buy property. But when it was such a good deal, I'd buy it. And it's doubled and tripled. And so, you know, good things happen. And, you know, it doesn't have to be financial, but financial things does happen to us. And I'll close with a thing that Chuck Chamberlain said one time. He said, I think it was his 30th birthday. Well, I want to share one thing about Duke first. Because Duke, on my 25th birthday, they throwed a party. They called it a roast, but everybody was praising me. And they called on Duke. And Duke got up there and he said, I was in the fourth grade before I found out everybody's dad don't go to AA. But here about 2 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, I was talking to Duke on the phone. And I said, you know, son, you guys, I've never thanked you and Debbie, but you've always been good kids. You never give me any trouble. I never had a bit of problem with you. And I hear of people that really have some problems with their kids. And I'm just proud of the fact that you guys never give me any trouble. You've grown into adults and families, and just everything has been perfect. So I just wanted to thank you for being so good. I said, I know there was opportunities out there. He said, yeah, there was opportunities, but we knew you wouldn't approve. And then he said, me and Debbie always wanted to please you, Daddy. What a compliment, huh? And that's all due to Alcoholics Anonymous. And now I'll close with Chuck Chamberlain saying, when he was 30 years sober at his party, he said, when I was laying on the floor, chewing on my tongue and turning blue, my wife a-crying, my kids a-screaming, and the doctor looking and saying, Chuck, if I was you, I wouldn't do this no more. He said, had I known that was going to be 30 years without drinking, I'd have had one more drink. Thank you.